and welcome to Condensed Histories with me, Greg Chapman.
And me, Jem Deducci.
And I'll tell you what, Jem, I've had a fantastic weekend. I've actually been down in Wellingborough this weekend. I say down in Wellingborough.
Tell me more.
Well, I was at the Medieval Festival, and I actually met up while I was there with Nuka Raven, who is our reenactor friend.
Yes.
For those people who haven't heard Nuka's interview on the podcast, if you go back to, I think it's about episode 80, somewhere around there, you'll find Nuka being interviewed all about reenactors when Jem decided that he was going to call out the entire reenactment brigade in a Fast Five, and so I had to bring in a reenactor to kind of offer up a little bit of defence. But we had a really good weekend over in Wellingborough. As you can tell, a weekend of sleeping in a field and shouting in what, let's face it, is, I was going to say, unseasonable warmth. I think that kind of makes sense. It's far too hot for summer in England at this point in time. Has kind of destroyed my voice, so do expect that to be a little bit rough and ready during the course of the day. But it's been it was really an interesting event, because as always happens with these events, you go along, and as you said yourself, Jem, you know, reenactors, they can't be entirely historically accurate. And as we all know, I don't even try to be entirely historically accurate in my dress or period clothes or my unicycle, which is definitely not period. But it was a really, really interesting event. I think one of the things that really struck me, actually, one of the things I've learnt this weekend from history is we did a podcast quite a while back about how the winter affects history. How does snow affect battles?
I believe we did that during winter.
I believe we did. Well, we may have to look at the opposite end of things at some point, because as part of the evening's entertainment, Nuka and his band of guards, I believe it's the Bifrost Guard, did actually turn up at the end of one of my shows, arrest me, and sentence me to be shot with arrows. What this meant, in essence, was I was then taken off. I was padded up with a gambeson, a padded jacket. I then had full chainmail draped over me. An arming helmet and an armor helmet. And I was then put down at the end of a little archery range, and I had blunted arrows fired at me, which, let me tell you, still hurts a little bit even through all of that. You still feel it when they hit. But what struck me immediately is I got down there, and yes, I'd done a show, so I was already a bit hot. But once that jacket went on, that big padded armor jacket, and then the chainmail went on, and the weight of the chainmail, and then he put the helmet on, and I popped down the visor. The first thing I thought was, I'm going to pass out, and I had to pop the visor straight open and say, get me some water quickly. Then I had a bit of a drink of water, and then, you know, I stayed in that armour basically for as little time as possible at that point in time. And I know the other knights there were having sort of similar trouble. And it does strike me that when we think of people going into battle and things like that, we think about the attack, we think about the battle, we think about the dangers of battle and things like that. But how many knights, if a battle was being fought in the heat of the summer, as opposed to, we've talked about the problems with it being fought in the winter, the rain, the conditions, but imagine trying to fight in the heat of the summer. And how many soldiers just went onto the battlefield and just passed straight out because of the heat? That was something that struck me this weekend.
Greg, allow me to interject. I think that is such a good idea. I think that our plans for this particular podcast, let's move it to the next podcast. Let's do that now, because I've got some good examples. Sounds like you've got some other things in your mind. Let's strike while the iron's hot. How's that sound?
Okay.
By the way, guys, this was not planned. I have just completely ambushed my co-presenter.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
Let's go with that. Let's go with a whole new podcast. Our podcast, we will do a different podcast another day. Today we are podcasting about why this incredible heat is not just good, not just bad for podcasters who are sweltering and have bad voices, but also made things a little bit difficult in history. So,
because if you know, I know we bounce around throughout history, and you always accuse me of doing exotic history, but the thing that I fell in love with, if that's correct, perhaps the right word, in the 1990s, and I know, we've never actually done a podcast about this on this channel, but we did it when I was a guest on your other sort of podcast from way back when, but I specialized with the Crusades. I'm one of the few people who have a medieval history GCSE, and that's when I first sort of started finding out about the history. The Crusades, continued it into A-level. Obviously, I did a degree that was linked to that, and my dissertation was specifically on the Mongol expansion of the 13th century and its impact on the crusading movement, of which my lecturer turned around and said, "You're just trying to fit in as much violence as possible with that one, aren't you, Jem?" And my answer was, yes, I am. But one of the things about it is that in the Middle East, you have the Middle Eastern warriors who are very much adapted to incredibly hot summers. But you've got the Western knights who are dressed as if they're still in France, England, Germany, in the baking heat of the Middle East in high summer. And when you're talking about that, I mean, what a lot of people don't realize, but you just already mentioned it, is with a sort of 13th century or 12th century medieval knight, yes, they are wearing the mail armor. By the way, I conditioned myself to call it mail armor because I was at the Royal Armouries at Leeds behind the scenes, and I was talking to this guy and I referred to chain mail, and he went, "It's not chain mail. You know, if you look at a chain and then you look at what this beautiful mesh of mail armor is, they are very, very different." He got really sort of he taught me through it in a very positive way, but I could see that he was a little offended that I would use that term. So that's why I try and do it. Everybody else calls it chainmail, but yeah, he has a point that it is a mesh. It's not a chain. But anyway, the point is people think they only wear that, but as you said, that's quite rough against the skin, and also for a little protection, there's the gambeson underneath it, which is basically a padded woolen garment. So you're wearing, in essence, a giant cardigan, and then on top of that, you've got metal and a metal helmet under the baking sort of 35 degree, 40 degree heat of a Middle Eastern summer, and these guys were meant to fight in it. And actually, one of the most famous battles of the Crusades, the Battle of Hattin, was between the Crusader states and Saladin, which everybody's heard of. And the critical thing was the Crusaders had enough troops to either man all their garrisons of all their castles and fortresses, or use all those men in a big pitched battle. And Saladin desperately wanted the big pitched battle because if he could get them all in one place at one time, he could probably defeat most of the kingdom all in one battle. And there were a number of crusaders going, "No, let's not do this," because that's exactly what Saladin wants. But cutting a long story short, they took the bait. But here's the thing, Saladin would sort of set himself up in a place he knew they would find him. But on the way, he poisoned all the wells. He burnt all the bushes. And what all the chronicles talk about is the extreme heat and the knights going sort of almost crazy with thirst. And so, if you like, the battle, yes, it was a crushing defeat for Saladin. Crushing defeat for the Crusaders, crushing victory for Saladin. But in a way, he'd already won the battle just because he used the weather and the environment around him before it had even turned to fighting. And, you know, there are other very cool things about that battle. But more than anything else, what strikes you when you read accounts about that battle is the heat, less so the violence.
Yeah.
I've talked a lot there. What do you think, Greg?
I think the first thing you tried to do there straight away was put my little moan about being in a suit of armour in 25 degrees but to complete shame by pointing out how much hotter it was over when they were fighting in the Crusades.
No, but you were still hot and uncomfortable. By the way, I don't think it was 25 degrees. We're talking about yesterday, which is Sunday. I'm pretty sure the mercury went over 30 degrees yesterday. It was hot.
It was hot. And yeah, and like you say, a lot of people don't think, and I don't always think about it. When I think about a knight in armour, you think about the armour. You think about the mail or the chain mail, whichever one you want to refer to it as. And there's a lot of things you don't think about with that. And like you say, that padded jacket, what you got to think of is, I mean, I was, as I say, I was in a padded jacket and then the mail, and then these are reduced force bows. You know, okay, I'm being shot from a distance. I don't know what it was, maybe 20 feet, something like that. It wasn't a long distance they were shooting me from. So they were reduced power bows anyway. They weren't, you know, obviously there's no chance of them piercing the mail, but it still had an impact. You still feel it going through. Now, modify that to trying to defend somebody from the force of either a sword blow or even trying to defend someone from the force of an arrow fired from a full-strength longbow. I mean, if you manage to stop the actual arrow piercing the armour and the skin, that is still an incredible force, and that's why you need quite so much padding underneath. But, I mean, the whole thing with the armour, I mean, the first thing first is just getting into the stuff is a pain enough. It's this huge, huge, heavy stuff. But the thing comes down to is, what is the other option? You know, what do you do if you want to protect yourself, but you do have that problem with the heat? What was the alternative solution?
Well, when you're looking at the things like the Mamluk cavalry or the sort of Sipahis or, you know, the irregular Turkish horse archers, there are lots of different names for these sort of groups of people. First of all, well, really what it boiled down to a lot in the Middle East between Western and Eastern armies is the Westerners tended to have heavy armor. They were heavy cavalry in every sense, thick armor, you know, lances, mail horses. And it, quite often, if you could sort of wedge in the Islamic forces, say, against a river or something where there was kind of nowhere for them to maneuver, it was in essence a hot knife through butter. You know, you just have these Crusader knights just smashing through these much lighter cavalry. But looking at what the Muslim archers and horse archers would have, some of them would have silks, but you know, they would have very light cloth material, maybe leather armor. They did have some heavy cavalry, again with mail armor on, never plate really. A few people had like breastplates, but that was about it. But they didn't really develop plate armor. What was the point in somewhere like Palestine? And their horses were female, so they were far more agile. They were far lighter, potentially cooler. Also, you know, a lot of the battles didn't take place at noon, which was at the absolute hottest time of the year. You know, if it was like a Muslim versus Muslim army, they'd understand the arid conditions, they'd understand the, you know, the realities of the environment. And quite often there were sort of dawn attacks, night raids, or, you know, there might be something later on in the afternoon, still hot, but it would not as hot as just literally fighting over the you know, the central time of the day when it was at its most harsh, the sunlight. And also you see the importance of water, you see the importance of things like oases, but also the sarais, the caravanserais, which is where it was just a place for respite against the harsh environment out there. So, you know, they adapted as far as they possibly could. Shade was important. Any kind of place with trees was important. And you know, I'm sort of giving you a broad brushstrokes here, but it took the Westerners a few generations to work out how to sort of properly adapt to the Eastern way of fighting. But saying that, though, the Battle of Hattin was about 100 years into the Crusader period in the Middle East, and they still got suckered into a massive defeat and fighting exactly the way the enemy wanted them to fight, which rarely turns out good for an army.
Well, while we were talking about this, because you caught me on the hop, I thought I'd see if I could find a modern example, a really modern example of the heat affecting armies in battles, and sort of working along the same lines as you said there. Basically, what we're talking about there is what the British troops did was they took the fighting methods required for one climate and took them to another climate, and it doesn't work. I mean, in the same way, had the Crusades been reversed, had it been Saladin, his troops, had they gone up to England wearing those silks and light armour, they probably would have faced a much, much harder time, because the heavy armour there, where the knights were able to move quicker, they wouldn't have had the problem with heat. It probably would have had an effect going the other way round. Well,
oh, absolutely. And if we just took a step, sorry to interrupt, Greg, let's say about a century further, so we've now got the proper introduction of the longbow. The longbow could fire further and faster than, you know, the horse cavalry. cavalry archers, that's a real skill. You know, still in Hungary, there are some guys who can, riding at full gallop, be able to fire a bow and hit a target. That is hard. It's hard to ride a horse at full gallop. It's hard to fire a bow and arrow and hit a target. Try doing both of those at the same time. You know, that, you know, it, and, you know, drawing and still galloping, and you're only using your feet. Real, real skill there. But if you had a bunch of these, as you say, sort of like rather flashy horse archers against a bunch of English peasants with longbows, the longbowmen would absolutely decimate them. For starters, they got much more range. So as these guys were coming in, a host of them would have been slaughtered that way. So you're absolutely right. Every country has its own sort of advantages and adapts to its own environment. But please, I interrupted, I'm sorry. Back over to you.
Well, I'm just going to interrupt myself as well, because on your subject of horseback archers, as you know, Jem, I am a big fan of historical experimentation and using recreation of historical events and methods in order to learn a little bit more about them. And I actually have first-hand experience of how difficult it must have been to fire a bow from the back of a horse and attempt to hit any sort of target. Because a few weeks ago, I was up at the Crewe Steampunk Festival, and it was,
of course, I know we've been talking a lot about that. I'm not seeing how this is linked to horse archers, but well, hey, if somebody was there doing it, great.
Well, a friend of mine has a little archery range. It was actually the same guy who I ended up standing in front of while he shot me at the weekend. And we had one of the mornings, and it was a slightly slow morning. You know, it was a sluggish bank holiday Monday morning. There was a slight bit of drizzle in the air. People weren't coming out till a little bit later. And we, as we often tend to do if there's not people around, got bored. And when we get bored, one of us will suddenly go, why don't we try? And so I said, well, why don't I try?
That's never a good start, but okay.
Why don't I try a drive-by shooting on a unicycle? Now, so I got one of his longbows. And I'll tell you what, when you think about, you know, standing there, pulling a longbow, firing it, I've done a fair amount of archery, especially when I was younger, and I'm pretty good. Standing there during the day, I could pick up his longbow and I could hit the helmet on this figure every time. Now, this isn't even going at the speed of a galloping horse. This is sitting on a unicycle, riding past the target, and trying to get a shot into the target. And it just took me attempt after attempt after attempt after attempt. And in the end, I think, to be honest, I got lucky rather than I managed to, just to try and figure out the movement of your own body. Because obviously, whenever you do any sort of shooting or archery, I mean, you get to the point where in the Olympics, they even hold their breath when they're shooting to make sure their slightest body movement doesn't affect. But even, and I was, you know, as a unicycle travels about 2 miles an hour, you know, it's not much faster than a walking pace. And yet even on that, to try and line up the fact that the unicycle was moving in one direction, my body was obviously powering it, my body was moving, my arms were swinging around, and then to try and get a shot on target from an incredibly close distance was so difficult. And so, yeah, you can understand how much skill these people needed. But that was just an aside, just because I happened to have been doing drive-by medieval shooting on a unicycle fairly recently, which is...
Of course you know, were. Of course,
as we do. Yes. But I want to bring this right up to date. I'm going to bring this up to February of 2014, actually. And
okay, that's pretty new.
Yeah, I'm looking at the Mail Online from India, if anyone wants to actually look up this article after I've finished, where what it appears has happened is that the Indian Army have ordered a whole load of T-90 tanks from Russia. Now, I want you to try and think of the conditions that they might be facing in Russia. And these tanks were then deployed in the Rajasthan desert. And the high command decided that they could save a little bit of money. Despite the recommendations of trial teams, they thought they'd save a little bit of money by not fitting these tanks with air conditioning. Now, you think, well, yeah, okay, maybe the crew can put up with a little bit of heat. They can always open the open a hatch on the top, get a little bit of air in, you know, same as we do in our car if we don't have aircon, wind a window down. I'm sure that's a good idea in a tank. But it was worse than that, because these components, obviously, these tanks were built, tested in Russia. The components were tested for Russia. You put them in the middle of the desert, and suddenly they found that certain systems, including the thermal imaging sights, and the actual missile firing mechanisms started to deteriorate pretty quickly because they couldn't cope with the heat of the desert. And so we see straight away, even today, you have a problem. You cannot build a war machine that functions in lots of different environments. You have to take the time to modify and adapt. If you built something for a cooler environment and you're going to stick it in the heat, you do have to cool it down.
Okay, you've fired off so many bits of my brain. Let's, rather than just talking about the Crusades and stuff like that, I liked your one over in India. I've got something to tell you in a moment, but the thing about the heat stuff, so bear with me, everybody. Obviously, if there are any children listening, you won't have seen this movie, but when you grow up a bit bigger, you should really check it out. Greg, have you seen the original Predator?
Yes, I have.
Okay, so for those of you who haven't seen this, and if you haven't, unless you're under 18, you really should see this movie, but it's about an alien hunting down a bunch of soldiers in a jungle, and you sometimes see things from the point of view of the alien, and it's kind of like that heat vision, as you've seen. And this is made in the late 80s. They didn't have a lot of computer tech to use, so you would assume that really was heat vision. But here's the thing, the jungle itself was over 30 degrees, at which point, exactly as you said, that was, I'm sure nowadays it's better, but even then there are limitations. And the point is, if the background is hotter than body heat, it just all looks the same. They even went as far as trying to drench areas of the jungle with ice water to cool it down so you could see the human beings better. It still didn't work. And they had to put in very, very basic kind of CGI in post-production on that. So it isn't quite what you think you're seeing in that movie. But anyway, the thing that you're talking about, tanks there, what that brought to mind, and also talking about the heat, is perhaps one of the most famous eras or events which led to heat everywhere, causing problems for all the fighters, is World War II and the North Africa campaign. And I seem to remember that there were the stories of soldiers, both sides, flicking, you know, sort of like frying eggs on their tanks because it got that hot at certain times. And both sides, because there were basically no civilians around, there was an unwritten rule that they just wouldn't fire at each other at breakfast time. You know, look, can we just get some breakfast in us? Then we can start the war. Thank you very much. But the one thing that both sides loathed more than each other was the flies, the black flies everywhere. And, you know, there was sort of almost competitions to sort of how many of these things can you kill, because they got into the food and they were just annoying. And again, well, there's certainly no air conditioning in the tanks in those days, and there was a limit to how long you could sit in the tanks, and you absolutely you'd open every hatch available to try and get some kind of air into them. So in a way, yes, it was a battle between, you know, Montgomery and Rommel and other generals as well, but at the same time it was like they were battling against the elements. And the sand also got into everything. You're mentioning there about sort of like degradation of gear. But, you know, these tanks were not designed to go across a desert. And while they, you know, when they work really well. Tracks work well over sand. But the finer particles of sand, they would get into gears and so on and so forth. So maintenance, the trucks and tanks and vehicles were constantly breaking down. So it was a battle, really, of man against the environment rather than just man against man.
And lest we forget that obviously sometimes people kind of rely on these environmental factors to protect them. They rely on the fact that you can't beat certain environments. At least that's the theory. And, you know, we have these stories from the war times of people crossing deserts, doing a forced march across a desert, risking everything because they can't carry enough water. I forget the name of the famous one, the famous town that they took over in the deserts from the Germans. And it was a case of, if they couldn't stop the German soldiers blowing up the wells, then they could cross the desert, attack the city, take control of the city, and it would all be for nothing. Because if the Germans managed to destroy the water supply before they had actually won the battle, then they had no hope whatsoever. They were all going to die anyway. And when we start looking at the conditions all over the world, and we try and think how many environments we actually send soldiers to battle him. No, we as human beings, not necessarily me and you, Jim, I don't think we usually send soldiers out too often.
No, not really.
In a number of environments, we send people out into to fight in, where, as a general rule, there is no mass human inhabitation. We just don't have humans living there in any large numbers because the conditions don't suit people living there. And yet, when it comes to times of war, we do send soldiers out to fight in these extreme conditions. And when you send soldiers out, because you think of, yes, there are nomadic tribes living in a desert. There are people that live in the deserts. And then you look at the scale of something like Camp Bastion, the huge military camp, and you think, but that is an extra city being shoved down in the middle of what is essentially desert country. You're suddenly putting so much extra strain on very, very limited resources in a place where it's incredibly hard to live in the first place. And it's the same with whatever you do. When they sent the soldiers out, to take us back to the beginning of the episode because we're coming towards the end, when they sent the soldiers out to the Crusades or anywhere else, you are sending out a huge number of people into what are, generally speaking, fairly inhospitable climates, especially for people who are used to a much cooler, much more, much lower temperatures, or just a different environment entirely.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I seem to remember reading somewhere that Camp Bastion, which was the major British camp in Afghanistan recently, it's obviously, it's all gone now. That's the other thing. So they set it up and then it's pretty much all disappeared. But I seem to remember at its peak, it was equated to basically the same size as Reading. And that's a major city in Britain. But anyway, I think Afghanistan's also another interesting one. Loads of armies have passed through Afghanistan. It's a bit of a myth, actually. You get some people in the West saying nobody successfully invaded Afghanistan. It's like, well, that's not true. You've got Alexander the Great. You've got the Islamic Caliphate. That's why they're all Muslim. You've got the Mongols. You've got Tamerlane. Actually, quite a lot of people have invaded Afghanistan. And the other one that the Afghani says, it's easy to invade. It's hard to leave. It's like, but again, you actually look at the history. It's not particularly true. But the interesting thing about the place is it's so inhospitable. I mean, that's one thing that all the armies throughout the millennia agree on. In the summer, it is a baking hot desert, and in the winter, particularly up in the mountains, you know, it's absolutely sub-zero, freezing cold, and you've got to deal with snow. Those are two very, very different environments, which you have to have your troops equipped for if you're going to stay there for any amount of time. It also means the population is very, very sparse, and you go back to limited resources. Just very briefly on that, we were talking on the winter one about how the reason why you tended not to fight wars in the winter was because where's the food? You've got to feed the army. The armies tend to feed off the land. In the summertime, you quite often hear about scorched earth policies or burnt ground policies, called different, slightly different things, where, like, for example, perhaps the most famous, going back to World War II, is when the Germans invaded Russia, Operation Barbarossa. Sorry, Soviet Union. They only ended up invading only 4% of Russia, but they did invade places like Ukraine, Belarus, Poland, etc. Anyway, point is, as the Russians and Soviet forces were retreating, they were making sure they were destroying as much of the resource that the Germans might need or might have counted on to get there. Similar thing with Napoleon. You know, they burnt Napoleon out of Moscow that was obviously wintertime. But again, they made sure that there was no shelter for him, so he had to leave. And again, we've got environmental factors impacting on what you think is all about shooting, and it just isn't as simple as that. I do think that people underestimate how much weather, environment, geography impact whether that king or that general or that warlord was successful or not. We tend to, as you said, emphasize on the battles and not all the stuff around the battles. I think that's probably where I'm going to stop for today. Any other thoughts?
I'm just going to, because we are out of time, but when you say about environmental factors, the two things, or the major subject with this that we didn't discuss at all was, of course, the sea, where these environmental
Another
factors
time.
Ramp up significantly. So before everyone, you know, sort of comes in and says, we didn't mention any of the major naval battles that suddenly got mucked up by a sudden storm, I think we'll do that another time. We'll talk about how storms affect battles or something like that. But for now, Jim, yes, Very quickly, we are out of time. Do you have something you'd like to plug? I think you wrote a book about the Crusades.
Yes, Deus Vult, D-E-U-S-V-U-L-T, Deus Vult, A Concise History of the Crusades by Jem Deduchu. My first published book, actually. Still good, though. Really enjoyed writing that one. Check it out if you like some of this stuff about hot knights. but literally knights that are hot. K-N-I-G-H-T. But, Greg, but what are you doing recording this one, and it's basically going to be out tomorrow. What are you doing over the weekend? What's coming up soon on your diary?
Do you know what's really great is we've got one where we're recording it spot on. It's coming out tomorrow, which means I can tell you exactly what I'm doing this weekend. And I'm actually going to watch a show. I'm not performing at all this weekend. I got tickets to go and see the big Penn and Teller Magic show up in London. So that's what I'll be doing. They've finally come over to the UK again, so I'm going to pop over and see them. But if anyone is around the following weekend, which is the first weekend in July, if anyone is anywhere near Hollowell, I will be at the big Hollowell Steam Rally. And don't forget that coming up over this summer, through the 6 weeks summer holiday, every Wednesday during the 6 weeks summer holiday, I do stop by Sudley Castle and I do my shows there every Wednesday through the 6 weeks summer holiday. And I believe every Tuesday during the 6 weeks summer holiday, I am going to be at the Forge Mill Museum in Redditch. And if you're looking to come and see one of my shows and you're not near either of those, then do go and check out my calendar online at condensedhistories.com. And while you're there, do check out condensedhistories.com/gems to see some lovely pictures of me and Jem. And also, that is where you want to click on the links when you're going to buy your copy of Deus Vult. Because anything you buy through that website, that gives us a little bit of extra money coming back to keep the podcast going. Now, that is all from us from this week. We really are out of time. Thank you so much to everyone who is listening to every single one of these episodes, especially those people who are sharing it around, who are getting involved, who tweet us on Twitter and stuff like that. It is
absolutely
so great that we got this little community we're building up. But for now, thank you so much to my wonderful co-host, Mr. Jem Deduchu.
And thank you to my wonderful co-host and inspiration of today's podcast, Greg Chapman.
And thank you very much for listening. Goodbye and take care.